Welcome to the So-and-So series, readings by early career poets.
Let's all at one time turn our cell phones off.
What if we already did?
Then consider yourself, you have extra credit. Well, thanks so much for coming. Thanks to everybody that lives here. Raise your hand if you live here. Robert, or Bob. Mary, so thank them for letting us have this wonderful space. So the reason why that we are here is because of a collaboration between So-and-So Series and Rope-A-Dope Press, run by Mary. And what she's done is letterpressing broadsides. She's making the letterpress here of one poem for each of the next 6 months of So-and-So Series poets. And she's having it one artist per month. And Anna did this month's work on the right-hand side here. And she did a screen print. And these will be available in the back for $12. And eventually they will be collected into a book. They're called the Manila Broadsides. I don't even know what the book's going to be called. Something like that. It'll be eventually scanned into an online magazine, and a lot of it will be for purchase also as a collected whole at the AWP conference in New York at the end of January this year. So a list of the artists. So like I said, Anna was tonight. August is James Weinberg. Catherine Bourassa Hébert. Is that even close? October is Sadie Bliss. November is Robert Davies. Is that Bob? Awesome. And then Nick Golasek, also here. Oh. Excellent, we have a lot of people here. Hello.
This is great.
There's also poets' books back there, two by Ravi Shankar. One is a collaboration from Red Livingston, will be a name that comes up a couple times tonight. No Tell Brotel, it's my favorite. So yes, purchase these. Excellent, okay. Our first reader is Schaefer Hall. If you'd like to read his normal bio, go on the website at the So-and-So Series. .blogspot.com. I'm going to read a blurb from Dan Brady. Hall is a companion. This is about his book, Never Cry Wolf. Right? Do you have it with you?
Yeah.
Raise it high and proud. Never Cry Wolf. Put out by No Tell Motel, Red Livingston's Press. Hall is a companion on the long trails, a generous bartender, a joking linguist, a wise cowboy, a charming southern gentleman, a surrealist with 2 feet on the ground, a keen observer with plentiful imagination. As he writes in A Malfunction at the Junction, with Never Cry Wolf, Schaefer Hall has loosed into the world a tremendous wink. And that is Dan Brady. You can find a review of his book at barrelhousemag.com, an interview at kickingwind.com, Kate Greenstreet's website, and his blog is schaeferhall.blogspot.com. Schaefer Hall. We're setting the whole thing.
Thanks. So this microphone is not connected to the recording process.
No, you're recording right now.
So I can just turn this off, right?
As long as everybody's...
Hi, folks. How are you? My name is Schaefer Hall. And my first poem is called Ornithology for Beginners. Birds are like lawyers. Their feathery outfits are complicated, but they fit. And in a fit of punishment, which some call justice, a bird is both a judge and a quick-eyed crime. In a basement, birds are captives, but on earth their long legs stride widely. And I'm gonna read from Never Cry Wolf now, and I was gonna tell folks, what are we talking, we never decided on a word. If you can tell me at the end of the reading, the number of the times I say the word blue, I'll give you this copy of the book, which, the fun thing about this one is that when we were sitting at Daisy Buchanan's earlier this afternoon, I let Chris and Alicia and John and our other friends, Jesse and Noah and Rachel and the bartender, pick the poems that I'm going to read today. So they're all marked up in here. And also you'll have a copy of this poem that I wrote for John, Ornithology for Beginners, that was written at that bar there too. And that's the only copy of it. So number of times I say blue, pay attention. I'm just going to read these poems in order. How to survive on land and sea. Evening came with no nickels for dancing. Earlier in the day, a public opinion poll of two Mexican kids indicated 100% of two Mexican kids prefer orange popsicles to their big brother's girl. From which it can be inferred that life is like a train, and we are cheap apartments, and we shake when the train rolls by. See for yourself, in the nickel light, a slender woman dances and mispronounces your name. Nick Burnett's American. Nick Burnett is my cousin. But he's young enough that I kind of consider him a nephew. He calls me Uncle Shake. Nick Burnett's America. Roy Orbison's Sublime, say Nick's four-year-old eyes. Nick provides incisive commentary, suburban decay, middle-aged paranoia, by throwing a brick through my uncle's rotted back fence. Nick, I say, watching him eat, I had forgotten the beauty of banana. This next one's another cousin. This one's called Avery's Possums. My cousin Avery has a deathly fear of possums. Avery's Possums. The horror. A five-year-old's intransitive loathing finds an object in a blissfully ignorant marsupial. Let's spring blossom, little possum. Your world is worse than you know. Keep your rat's teeth clean on the pine wood of my fence. Let the shadow you cast on my bedroom wall be large. Sunflowers are monsters to the mice in the field. Terror. Count the T's on your tongue. Forget. Tuxedo. Azteca. Now knit several S's into a blanket for your mouth. Estoy. Some sort of providence. Give yourself some room now with silent sounds. Not. Knowingly. Now pronounce the commas as you try to get away. John Gotti is hunting Jameson from beyond the grave. When I first moved to New York City, it was right at the time of the last of the RICO roundups, where they're taking care of all the, you know, the mobs in New York City and in Brooklyn. And I moved up there. My best friend was living up there at the time, and he was bartending at this place called Milo's in East Williamsburg, which was, it's been there for like 100 years, and there's all these legends about so-and-so being buried in the backyard, and you're up to your neck in Italians when you hang around there. And when I was looking for jobs moving to New York, what I do is just spend his whole day shift sitting there at the bar drinking double well gin and tonics and then go home. But there was the day of that last particular RICO roundup, and we just watched all these old Italian guys come in and have these quiet conversations at these little tables in the corner, and then they would walk away like they were all shoring up their loyalties or whatever. Which was interesting for me, but for Jameson, he was right there in the middle of all that. And the Daily News and the Post are all blasting these headlines about the horrible things that the Gotti family's done. And it started to actually get to Jameson a little bit, and he started to have nightmares. And like it started to like actually cause problems because he's waking his girlfriend up in the middle of the night with his nightmares he's having. So that's where this one came. John Gotti is haunting Jameson from beyond the grave. Why the sleepless nights, Jameson? Are you aghast at the indignity of all those rampant mourners eating tragedy? Or would some maligned authority have you stone tablet everybody, telling us of the beauty that will be when we all hang on ropes from trees? And what of your woman, as her arm is ripped from its socket when you wake up sweating in the night? John Gotti, his fury is gravity. The planets that are our brains orbit fitfully. And what next? Some of the folks who picked these poems marked them on the table of contents, and others marked them on the actual poem. A Sunday brunch ordeal. This is about getting out of prison. I've never been to prison, but I imagine the hardest thing about getting out of prison is hanging around with, like, your grandma, you know, and like, oh, what do we talk about now? A Sunday brunch ordeal. The refined use of cutlery's rules, suspended like a mobile midair. Aunt Cindy will do the talking. For your lungs, they're hard as coconuts. Click, click. It's actually a drip that your mind is misinterpreting in its paralysis. You clench your teeth and tell yourself, I want to be that sincere. Mornings like these are a longing for no curtains, for rats unimpeded by traps, for irons, for quiet, for a cold home made of stone. I don't know who picked this one, but I like it. I like to read this poem in the voice of Christopher Lloyd. upon this is a, like I was taking care of these friends' fish, and there's nothing that you can do for a fish. You can't give a fish CPR or nothing. You just gotta feed them regularly and hope that they survive. But I was taking these cichlids, you know, these, you know, they're not expensive fish, but they're temperamental fish, and you know, they were close to all of them. These folks went off to Europe, and there was a case of the Malawi bloat or some weird fish disease going around the tank, so I just kind of had to watch and hope that none of them started swimming upside down or nothing. So that's what this is. Upon the death of a fish, weep for me, you friends who still can weep. Herman the little carp is belly up. It's Christmas time, and my soul is very small. I had some gin to make me tall again. Herman's eyes begged for that medicine. Who among us could deny a fish a drink? And my mistress, she will have my skin. Kathy, this one has a, this one has an exclamation point next. Kathy, oh, cause it's a Boston poem, I bet. Kathy, folks these days talk a lot about where rock and roll's gone off to lately, leaving us all so lonely and high. I don't think I'll tell them that I kissed it over the Charles, where the Mass Ave bridge starts to rise. Not sure if I actually have time for the douche story. I lived in Houston in a little garage apartment with my roommate at the time, Bob, and we got the Sunday newspaper, and I don't know if it's the same the world round, but our Sunday newspaper would occasionally have little one like little samples of shampoo or something that came with it. So one Sunday, the Sunday newspaper shows up, and it has a single-use douche attached to it. And so I'm sitting here standing in front of the garage apartment holding this douche, wondering, you know, what Bob and I are supposed to do with it anyway. And I decided, so I walked up to the top floor where Bob slept, and I went into his to his backpack, and I stuck it, you know, in that area where he keeps all of his, like, special drafting pencils. He was an engineer. So that the next time, you know, when he went to class or whatever and went to reach for his pencils, he pulled out a douche. And so presumably at some point something like that happened, but Bob, being, you know, our relationship was such that Bob didn't say a word. He just kept the douche, went back to the house, went into one of my winter coats, which I wasn't wearing at the time, stuck it in the pocket. So when winter came around, I reached into my winter pocket and I found it. And then so then I took it back and went into like his hiking boots or something that he only wears where he's hiking, and stuck it in his hiking. And we don't live together anymore, but I don't know where the douche is. I fully expect to, like, you know, go camping or something and pull it out of my sleeping bag. The last days of blue cotton jerseys school catfish in the art of long blonde golden hair. It was the yellow bus ride. It was a yellow moon of golden hair winking at me over a green seat. I lived for a little slaw, maybe, or maybe for a warm yellow jacket. I needed a small yellow sound, high, girlish. Catfish left a feminine hygiene product in my jeans. Not a yellow flashlight, as John pointed out. Okay, just a couple of more poems from the book. Let's pick our favorites.
You haven't fucking said blue yet.
Oh.
You said it twice when you were talking about blue.
Well, there you go. You guys want to take this outside? That these two are dating. The evening wore blue. Last night.
Three. I'm gonna win this.
The evening wore. The evening wore blue. Last night we went prowling down Second Avenue, and I wore my favorite shirt, hoping with aim but without conviction that Anna would be back from L.A. and once again patrolling the Lower East Side. I stunned myself when I walked around a corner and saw the evening. It had outdressed me in blues and stars. Aha, Anna, I thought, West. Now, that was blues.
Yeah, this is debatable.
Hey, I'm the one who decides whether it counts or not. This last one that I'll read from the book is called Nautical Selection, and my friend John, this is just as much his as his mine. He edited this one heavily. It was a real disaster until he got a hold of it. Nautical Selection. Standing with his back to the harbor, he addressed his audience on his times at sea. His inherited white face its markings impressed with the canals and melanoma of decades of nautical selection, highball mouthing that indulgence implicit in mortal correspondence, his back turned to the coast, then the harbor lights dimmed. But looking at the mainland as he was, to him it was a trick that the eye played on the mind. I am old, he thought, my sight is going. It was a gift to his audience, it confused him, they knew. The harbor lights spread indulgences across their faces. The harbor lights dimmed, and for a moment, the sea was another body, the shore was another land, and the boats on the water were other animals. To own a boat must be a pleasure. And the last poem I'm going to read by myself, as in written by me, it's called The Wide Side of Texas. And I don't know if you guys know Maureen Thorson from Big Game Books, but she does these things called Tiny Sides that are really neat. And she's still, this is number 38, she's going to do 50 of them. And I think she's still looking for poems if anybody has any to send her. And she does these really cool little editions that are just one single poem all into it. And the current, she does batches of five, and the current batch has myself and Cecily in them. And I have all five of them up there if anybody wants to take a look at them afterwards. This is called The Wide Side of Texas. Lubbock's esteemed Chamber of Commerce will tell you about the lonesome hoot of the tractor trailer. Let them tell you about the sorrowful tumbleweed twisted congenitally up with barbed wire up here on the big bony caprock. Let them tell you about the yellow sun record suns that rises to bisect the perfect line of the horizon in your eyes. And when your eyes tell you about 1,000 ducks on the pliers, you won't believe your ears. And when the last low, late 70s poured concrete building is destroyed, let the Chamber of Commerce call you home. Even though your mothers and sisters or friends have been wailing through the phone for you for years, your ears were deaf. You only answered the call of your own nostalgia. Now, up in Lubbock, the reference there, talking about playas, there's obviously, playas, Spanish for beach, but there are no beaches in West Texas, obviously. Playas are these sort of depressions in the landscape there where water gathers. So at the end of it, I got this little note, because nobody knows what a playa is unless you've been hanging around on the caprock. What is a playa lake? Approximately 25,000 shallow lakes, sometimes only 1 foot deep, dot the arid and semi-arid region of the southern Great Plains of Colorado, New Mexico, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas. The greatest concentration occurs in the high plains of Texas. These lakes are frequently ephemeral, containing water only seasonally. And this last poem is actually, we decided just before we were going to read that we were going to read each other's broadsides. So I'm going to read Cecily's broadside for my last poem. Self-portrait, which makes use of the Beaufort scale. I have my salted methodology. At zero, I drink tea that has a patent leather sheen. At one, aspirating with the unmoved weather vane, I own the H that behooves the iron horse. At two and three, my limbs begin their leaving. Such is the sprung wind's doing. My face at four recasts itself from watching to watch, dull still. A slow blink does not make me more fathomable. At five, I find myself in soft white shoes and stunted trees. At six, I whistle and not come hitheringly. A beast has yet to run out from the roots to please me. At any rate, my heart is down to three worn chambers and my shoes are soiled. I am a centerpiece of stemmed glass grapes at seven and eight. My swagger is affected. Even as nine opens the crock of applause, even as I am lambasted down to a mouth, I am being hyperbolic. Ten is when the truth wears a mended habit and rides a borrowed horse. 11, the truth is boneless and the horse is gone. In this wicked phalanx, not one image holds up as vertically as the mirror calm sea. All my metaphors are for looking backward, and I must respond by 12. It is always my turn to speak. Thanks, folks.
Our next poet is Cecily Parks. Her first collection of poems, Field, Folly, Snow, will be published by the University of Georgia Press in 2008. Her chapbook, Cold Work, was selected by Lee Young Lee for the 2005 Poetry Society of America New York Chapbook Fellowship. She has received fellowships and scholarships from the Breadloaf Writers Conference, the Bronx Writers Center, the McDowell Colony, and the UCross Foundation. She is currently a PhD candidate in English at the CUNY Graduate Center in New York. Cecily Park. Do you want the mic or sounds mic?
I think I'll go for it without the mic. I'm going to apologize beforehand if I start coughing. I'm getting over a really bad summer cold. Can you guys all hear me? Okay. I have my Ricola and my water. I was in Wyoming for the month of June this year, so I have a bunch of sort of Wild West Wyoming poems that I'll start with that are newer, and then I'll read some older stuff. Our despised and unhistoric West. Taxidermy could make an animal less desirable than right before the bullet, but wanting is like that, reflective fruit. For instance, if you arrive at the Occidental Hotel without baggage, you must pay first. Where else is lack worth ponying up for? And does that place have such heaviness to its curtains? Above the sticky radio, in the dust the ceiling fan threshes, a calligraphic constellation. Oh, oh, oh. Miss Petticoats, her lace as fine as lead in a decanter, pines on the fainting couch that velvetly begets the posture and sound of pining, each carnivorous syllable as small as a chapel in a town near a town named Buffalo. So much ardor in this interior, and though the hotel hallways may be narrow and dark, they are nothing if not long. There really was an Occidental Hotel, and when I was there, there was a whole TV crew there because they were filming a reality show called Girl Meets Cowboy. And I really wanted to be on it, but they did not need me. The Queen of Peas, P-E-A-S, okay. The Queen of Peas rides shotgun in the ice cream truck, singing along to the jingle she knows by heart, by shin, by skin. Waking is to happiness as the trash can is to raccoons, and then some. Without pockets, she plumbs the freezer for what fills the yellowing billow her hand-me-down apron makes. Rocket ship popsicles, varieties of sprinkles, sugar cones on the verge of brittle. What melts makes her run, because if the changing of states is not the universe's promise of a love abundant as a spider plant, it might be something better. Once dogged, the mundane refrains from her bare heels. The sidewalk gives and gives. It is the day before the longest day of the year. It is Indian summer. It is her birthday. It is snowing, and she has never heard of winter. There will always be a stranger to tell you how particulate your potpourri should be. Also, when I was in Wyoming, the cottonwood trees were releasing their seeds, so it was like it was snowing all the time, little cotton balls everywhere. And I became really fixated with it and wrote this poem. Dear William, I also took a lot of digital photos of the cotton ball seeds, which none of them turned out. It's just like blue squares, every single one. But Dear William, the cottonwoods are letting go as they ought to. Catkin, bit of cotton, each rib spindly, astral, petal, auroral, arboreal. Oral, oral fluff. Falling generosity, fertile interstices. Seed pods seeping in doorways, altering hallways, aleatory. A wedge clumping, a center shifting, all fringe, William, all fringe. Gauze and fuzz, radiant reproduction, a flocking through dissolution, announcing ripeness whitely. I have been thinking, a warm snow. This next poem I'll read because my mom is here, and she calls this my country song. I lost my horse. I was looking for an animal, calf or lamb, in the wire, metal, and hair along the fence line. Wire, metal, and hair, and there in the gully, a man I was pretending was dead. I pretended to leave him where the woods met the meadow, walking fast because I'd left my horse lashed to a fence I lost track of two valleys ago. Like a horse, I shied from the dead. Here, calf, here, lamb. I listened, wanting without my horse, my calf, or lamb, to be whip smart rather than wanted. I wore orange on antelope season's first afternoon and waited for the click that means the safety is off. When I spoke, my story was about picking skulls clean. I wanted everything to be afraid of me, the horseless girl who wanted to kill a dead man again. The white bed with a window behind its headboard became ice on the meadow road and a tree to stop a truck dead. I meant to trace my bootsteps back to the fence where things went wrong, find my horse mouthing the bit tied up by her reins. I looked for the horse because she looked safe enough to love. I looked for the calf or lamb because there was no calf or lamb. The man left before I could leave him, and I pretended the world was afraid of me because I was alone. I'm going to do two more of my own. I have nothing to sell here, which means you should all buy these beautiful broadsides if you want something of mine, because this is the nicest thing I've ever had my poem appear in. But you should also check out Maureen Thorson's Big Game book site. I just have got a tiny side made by her, and I haven't seen it yet, but she does a really great job from what I've seen in the past. And that's my plug. Luna Moth. Pale green and pressed against the window screen, shot through with field, you watch with four white eyes. The nighttime's corners curl, your underself unfurled to my one room of world. Kettle, counter, knife block. Having lived one of your life's six nights, you leave a limp silhouette where you left off. Let me be the creature circling your sleep. I am the most benign unknown. I do not touch. With what nights are left, plant your wingbeat in my sleep. Be the only hovering thing. If only you could teach me survival without sustenance, unworried love, how to find oneself at a window one morning and think nothing of what happens next. Letter to the Pistol Smith. As I watched my dog roll inside the ribcage of a long-dead cow, I thought of you. Your name escapes me, but please allow me to describe the cow. She was half a ribcage, really, and rented hide. As for color, you may assume splotches, black or brown and white, but you must picture my yellow dog ecstatic inside of her. I smelled what it was that the cow was becoming, and although the spires of her ribcage had been picked prettily clean, it may only have been a matter of weeks. She had been found. Some explanation as to the matter of the dog's ecstasy escaped me, but I wanted it. Happiness, I mean. As for myself, I have my own immaculate ribcage, a one-room schoolhouse, and even though I admit, have been picked at as if by beaks, I am not so tattered. We met once. You talked of metal, wood, and mother of pearl, but I was distracted with my death. What I mean to say is that I never knew your name, but I understood the thing you said about happiness, what it meant, even temporarily, like an oyster with a pearl. I am certain you meant the gun, but I was distracted because I wanted to be a mother. In your workroom, the rain was made of metal. I was being hit by triggers. Your workroom, limbed by barrels, black as a river a cow dies beside. What was that thing you said about the body? I am certain you meant the gun, but I was distracted because I wanted description and the gun had already been described. The last poem I'm going to read is by Ravi Shankar. It has some French in it. Fourier and Moore. Circuitry shrinks, processors in the tread of tactile mobile robots form a glandular parity that, Moore's law, in regularity shrinks tinier. From handheld to grapefruit, postage stamp to 10 pence, thumbnail clipping to wafer a few microns in size, paving the corporate highway for wearable computing solutions, wireless interfaces that embed the ear, face recognition programs that use Fourier analysis to add to perceptual fields an overlay like inside a broken photocopier, the names of clients, directions to each neighborhood's burrito stands, categorized by database into cost and proximity, all microprocessed into lenses of silver pairs of wraparound sunglasses. Mes amis, le monde change. Flashes before our eyes, nowness with deep roots. Thank you.
The next poet, Ravi Shankar. It was interesting how I came to meet Ravi. Where are Dave and Chrissy? Allison and I moved here 5 years ago, and we walked into our new friend's house. So we walked up, and then there's this poem in a frame on their wall, so I read it. I was like, Ravi Shankar? How do you know Ravi Shankar? The guy that was in Woodstock, obviously. The only paid musician at Woodstock. No, that was a friend of ours from our past. And then, anyway, so I came to know Ravi Shankar's work from a lot of online research, and eventually we met at some AWP. So Ravi Shankar is associate professor and poet in residence at Central Connecticut State University and the founding editor of the International Online Journal of the Arts, Drunken Boat. He has published a book of poems, which is up there, Instrumentality by Cherry Grove, named a finalist for the 2005 Connecticut Book Awards, and co-authored a chapbook with Reb Livingston, Wanton Textiles, No Tub Books, the same press Schaefer's book came out on. His creative and critical work has previously appeared in such publications as the Paris Review, Poets and Writers, Time Out New York, the Massachusetts Review, Fulcrum, McSweeney's, and the AWP Writers Chronicle, among many others. He has taught at Queens College, University of New Haven, and Columbia University, where he received his MFA in poetry. He has appeared as a commentator on NPR and Wesleyan Radio, and read his work in many places, including the Asia Society, St. Mark's Poetry Project, and the National Arts Club. He currently serves on the advisory council for the Connecticut Center for the Book, and along with Tina Chang and Nathalie Handel, is that even close to being right?
Yeah, sure,
Nathalie Handel, is co-editing an anthology of contemporary South Asian, East Asian poetry due out with W.W. Norton and Company in spring 2008. Ravi Shankar.
Great. Thank you, Chris. Let's get a big hand for Chris and for Mary and Bob for the space, for the So-and-So series, and Ropadope Press. It's my pleasure to be here. And to kind of switch things up, I'm actually going to start with Schaefer's little broadside. And again, all of these are upstairs. They're beautiful. This is Schaefer Hall's graduation night. Remember DuPont? The great French joke with his fine forgotten punchline? A soft rainstorm buzzed Broome Street that night as, in the basement, archivists personified themselves with last names and neatly coded numbers. It will take a mighty fucking to forget the way we talked that night, later on the rooftop. The order of everything eludes me now, but I never knew it. It's not forgotten. Like the funny stuff. Schaefer Hall. all right, so I think I'll start with a couple of poems from Instrumentality, and then I'll gotta still pimp the book, and then I'll read some newer poems. Chris mentioned that I'm teaching in Connecticut, live in Connecticut now, and so. I think I should read this poem by one of the great poets of Connecticut, Wallace Stevens. I teach right outside of Hartford where he worked, of course, and he used to work at an insurance company down there and walk to work every day. And so this comes from kind of reading his collected letters. This poem is called Blotched in Transmission. Bark of the birch, area of the oriole, grit of the sand grain. In the first stanza, I shall attempt to confiscate your essence, and each time you will slip through the noose of language, having no owner. Your brief appearance, though, is enough for the covetous page, conferring the illusion of presence. Even the breaths heaving in my chest do not belong to me. These wires of muscle tapping the hand's opposable thumb upon the spacebar, and the precise machinery of two pupils taking it in are not mine, though convenient to think so. In the second stanza, I shall feel like an outsider in my body. Emptied of the need to own, I become the pit of a plum. We color our language, Wallace Stevens wrote to Elsie Maul, and truth, being white, becomes blotched in transmission. In the third, final stanza, I will understand what he meant for a moment before the old words come flooding back. Now, Schaefer was talking a little bit about the mafia, and I have a poem. It's really actually not even related to the mafia, except for the fact that it takes place in San Francisco in this old bar, which was rumored to be an old mafiosa haunt. They had kind of two-way mirrors and these high-back velvet seats. And this poem is called Before Sunrise, San Francisco. Bruno's by sallow candlelight, the jacketed barkeep counting tips from a jam jar, and horseshoe booze burnished a bit too bright. Yet the stained mahogany walls and lazy lament of Spanish horns from speakers huddled in the corner speak a different language altogether, one that rolls effortlessly off the tongue and fills the room like myrrh. A promise sent that four walls can indeed keep out the world, that when horns wail for percussion and those walls are elegantly attired, why, there's no need to ponder the gristle in the mission outside. No need to wonder why that one left you, or why you're always too late. The weight of your existence roughly equals a martini glass in front of you. The thick mass of the past collapses into brightness, as well lit as the dripping star at the center of your table. Nod, snap your fingers, order another drink. Let horns grieve, let the wristwatch think on sheet before you leave. Tonight, the only eyes on you are two pimentos stuffed into olives, bloated with vermouth and gin. I think I'll read maybe one more from Instrumentality. This is, if I can find it here, a posthumous poem. I wrote it after I passed away. This is called How the Search Ended. Before the bus flattened me, I was searching for a scent, never to be remembered until it was smelled again. My fault, not the driver's. I had stopped to stare at a girl undressing in her window. I was too far to smell her. Earlier, I had visited a palm reader, not to trace my lifeline, merely to discover where to buy an oversized neon hand. On the way home, my head jangled with a premise. Life is either more or less serious than I imagine it to be. And then came the bus. Alright, and I think I'll read some newer poems. I have a couple of manuscripts that I'm working on simultaneously. And I'll start with this poem. Lived in New York for a while, and of course, one of the great things about New York is that you can get everything delivered, right? If you get Chinese food, you can get drugs, you can get whatever you want sent to your apartment. And in fact, as I found out, I lived in Prospect Heights in Brooklyn, that you could even get religion delivered. They had these things called mitzvah tanks, which during Passover, during Seder, they drive around and they have all this music playing, and you can actually go and get your the tefillin done, and you can fulfill your Jewish duties. And so I saw this mitzvah tank driving around when I was in Grand Army Plaza, and I was like, hey man, can I blow your shofar? I mean, come on, let me in there, what do you got? And I talked to this guy, which is just really the beginning of this poem. So it starts with this mitzvah tank, which populate the streets of New York once a year, or maybe even more. I don't know where they go after that, but this is a poem called The New Transcendence. The last time I was blindfolded, led from the city by mitzvah tank, Venus in retrograde eclipsed the moon. Silicon was up, the Dow down, the seasons rage, reality television. Later I would learn there was tefillin on board, but by then it was too late. More Republicans had ascended. Wiry hairs had begun to peek from my palms, the spring breeze chock-a-block with burnt wieners and aerosol. When squads of surgeons quit Mount Sinai to practice laser vaginal rejuvenation, there's bound to be a fuss that reaches far enough into Florida to upend bingo to turn the links into a place Camaros go to rust. See, we're all in this together. It's up to us to ensure sailors have less to spend during Fleet Week and more time to perfect salvos that can turn heads. Indeed, the current rate at which both manifestos and limericks are being produced is precipitously low. Plus, no one besides those daft with reenactment thinks to wear a tricorn hat. Instead, stitch for $3 a day in a refurbished bunker off the coast of Saipan, sneakers that enhance support without compromising breathability leave sole marks on the reflective floors in the new line of gastropubs' paperless bathrooms. Remember when all we had was our wits and a piece of jagged shale, when a keening in the bloodstream meant to hunt? Now click a mouse and dinner's at the door. Not that I'm against evolution, but in a certain sauce, progress tastes like regression. The construction of space with natal ease of access, everything amniotic and near at hand. In fact, I recently stuck Velcro to the universal remote control and installed a beer jockey in the couch. Charity, after all, like gingivitis, begins at home. Plus, toys have become the new transcendence. MP3s, DVDs, LCDs, SUVs, Palm Pilots, Pentium processors, rechargeable digital megapixel flat screens, they've all conspired to replace heaven with the notion that daylight is a zero-sum game, fodder for the latest distraction. So it spins, and as they say in Malta, to destroy the web, squash the spider. I'd rather drink beer and bust caps. Hedged in by nudniks on all sides, what's a blade to do? Moshe, it turns out, is no fan of hot dogs or klezmer. All right, then this next poem is called 10 Truisms and a Lie. And in fact, the title could be the lie. 10 Truisms and a Lie. Spatulas make passable fly swatters. On average, double coupons mean twice as much. To make a monkey a man, offer a cigarette. Orange is the new black. Orange is the new pink. Pink was the new black. Punk rock panders. Sour cream and onion sell more than salt and vinegar. Some prefer bromides to platitudes. The phrase irony is based on the misrelationship discovered by the I between existence and the idea of existence is plagiarized. Aristophanes meant well when he put Socrates in a basket. Even the mullet has risen. All right, and I read a few from this manuscript that I'm working on now. I have a number of these little short poems. I was calling them neo-pastorals for a while, but then I realized my friends told me that was really dorky. So they're no longer neo-pastorals. They're just pastoral poems. They're all in the same form. They're four tercets, four little three-line stanzas, and they have to do, as you'll see, with kind of natural and artificial kinds of objects. And I'll read a few of these. First one is called Slate. Slag heaps of stone, once an ancient seafloor, now metamorphosed into foliated slabs that jut in cragged angles, breakable along two planes of cleavage and grain, by splitters who lounge with lunch pails and idle pit hammers beside a rusted-out compressor, eyeing us warily. In a haze of dust, we trace the mottled texture, gray-green flat enough to hone a knife on, durable enough to use for sill and lintel, billiard table bed and grave marker. Nouns, unlike our fingers, resistant to weathering. This next one is called Dragonfly. A darting blue shard the length of a toothpick, with enough nerve and agility to mate in mid-air, to snatch midges from a hovering swarm faster than the purple marns will snatch it, each blip in its fractal flight an insect eaten. Compound eyes made from thousands of eyes, motion in all direction, pale soft naiad bodies hardened with exoskeleton, grown into wings that shimmer afternoon with rapid translucence, turning the plank boardwalk across the lake into a darning needle sketch of cross stitches. In time, they'll sew shut your eyelids and lips. This one is called The Oyster. And, of course, one of the great things about an oyster is that they're completely hermaphroditic. They actually change sex during their life, so they turn from male to female and back again a number of times. This is called Oyster. Gnarled as cliff face, two shells suctioned, one snug in another to shape a rocky pair. Bluish, held together by a dark protein hinge, content once in spatfall on a piling, changed from free swimming to inert life, filtering plankton from water, beating cilia. Dredge firmaments of bread and brine, now on ice with lemon wedges in a fish stall window. Soft, protrandic pulsations and mantle skirts, made liquid to itself, turning males female and back again, telling secrets that require a knife to pry open and vinegar to serve. Again, from Connecticut, one of our great cultural landmarks is something that I've written a pastoral about. This is Mohegan Sun. Where Uncas once wore a wampum collar, hand-carved from purple quag clamshells, a mammoth anodized rose looms, reflective and stainless off the interstate. Come play a bunting stretched over the road trumpets, and to descend the climate-controlled elevators into the clockless gaming floor pulsing with color is to uncover a spectacle broadcast on a wall of monitors, the fourth circle of hell, where avarice and excess roll boulders back and forth from Slotopoly to the Baccarat table. Time and again, I lose. Maybe read one more of these pastorals, and then this one is called Dark. 10 minutes ago there was gray in the sky, now there's none. Not a splotch of contour, and when I walk I listen for gravel to crunch underfoot so I don't end tooth in bushes. Darkness in New England has a flavor close to anise, a texture plush as peat moss. Fills the ear with cricket chirps, creaks with trees amending their branches. Smells like inside a new shoe when there's still tissue paper crumpled in the toe. Feeds full on paranoia. Bloats the walker with blind urge to run, summarily offset by the necessity to grope. And the last of these little pastorals I'll read is called Fireflies. There's a word in here, hotaru, which in Japanese apparently means, has a couple of connotations, but fireflies and a kind of form of love are two of the connotations that it has, which I thought was an interesting conjunction. Fireflies. Heavy drape beyond the slip-form stone wall, laid 1/2, 2/1, and shimmed by thin fingers of granite. Night falls moonless in a bindweed field, stretching to a dark grove that flares light, sudden, incessant, nitric. Electric sea green bursts more frequently seen on an arcade screen, signals a synchronous Morse code of mating, sent from lanterns rung in a rosette, enervated by neurons, souls of the dead in Japanese folklore. Hotaru. Actually, it's love. They only find each other in the dark. And to switch things up just a little bit, I'll read this poem, which needs probably no explanation. This is Ode to Quickies. Lunch hour. The time it takes to meet in anonymity leaves no more than 40 minutes. All preamble be damned. Hike up, hunker down, flush the color of bruised peaches, fall against casements and knots of garment, tilt towards me so I'm exposed while you rove a grove that grows in plum with each sucked in breath, while wordless communiques flash between us. Rapt to be here, so roused beyond the mere scope of skin, only skin can suffice to hold the charge of the rash dance that fits the wan light upon these chalky walls perfectly. And just read two more. I've actually been doing these little transliterations, I call them. When I grew up, I attended a lot of ceremonies at the Hindu temple, which were all in Sanskrit, which I couldn't understand, though I loved the music of it. And so I've been attempting to kind of, and I can't really even still speak it, but I've been doing these kind of transliterations. I've been taking a little bit of liberty with it. And this is a transliteration of the Gayatri Mantra, which is considered to be the kind of almost a prayer of strength, I guess. And when you're a young Indian man and you're coming of age, you have this kind of string ceremony in which your father teaches you this little sloga. And so I'll read it in Sanskrit, and then I'll read my little transliteration. It's from the Rig Veda. Om Bhuvasvaha Tatsavidarenyam Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi Deyo Yonaha Prajodayade. O manifest and unmanifest, wave and ray of breath, red lotus of insight, transfix us from eye to navel to throat. Under canopy of stars, spring from soil in an unbroken arc of light that we might immerse ourselves in until lit from within, like the sun itself. And I think I'll just finish off with this poem. It's called String Solo, and it has to do with those long winter nights when you're kind of alone. This will be my last poem. String Solo. Is it a sound, thrush gasp or throaty whimper, you keep wrapped in wax paper for midwinter nights, two hands and a vowel for company? Do long four fragments sing long enough to tilt wheel on axis, spill, slip strap, tippled glade, lace and fretwork, slow bloom of shoulder blade, clasp to unclasp, lamplight on hair sheen, orchids blooming at the wrist, gullies to swim in, the hour elongated, shivery, a smell to carry off on the thumb, peaty and overripe, but disappear too soon, turn muzzy. Jutting into the hour like craving for marmalade, how thickened past touch the pastiche. An urgent inclement burst of syrupy weather that drenches the doer in doing, a mellifluous jagged syntax that when recalled will not be real, not even close. Will any ecstatic dust remain like cardamom between the fingers? Camerato, all I know is the cello in imagination makes music less sweet than hearing its body vibrate before us, clenched between knees, flayed by a bow, cradled at the base of the neck. Thank you very much.
Another hand for Oliver Hoek. Next month, August 18th, Dan Boll, author of Work, author of Grand Mal, author of Kings of the Fucking Sea. Gina Myers, who is the editor of Lame House Press, also the editor of The Tiny. What's her, the knee that bends, what's her, Fear of the Knee Bending Backwards off of Hangman Press. And Dan Hoy, who's the editor of Soft Target and the author of Outtakes on Lame House Press. Next month, August 18th, right here. Thanks so much for coming. Enjoy the booze and snacks that are still here. And purchase all the broadsides and books that you can. And thanks again. Have a good night.